There's something on Netflix that I'm looking at right now that is just the eggplant emoji.
I just want to watch Daredevil season 3.
It's
And it
nice.
has taken 2 years to come out.
It's because they're doing every other show right now.
I know. Oh my gosh, I found that emoji thing you're talking about.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me today is a guest. We have friend of the show, Ashley Hitchcock. You've been on before, but introduce yourself again.
My name's Ashley Hitchcock. I'm 28. I live in Las Vegas, and I've been good friends with Cassidy for 7 years.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I didn't expect you to give that much information about yourself. Now you're going to get doxxed.
That was a standard icebreaker, like when you go to college classes and introduce yourself. So,
what's your major?
I graduated with a bachelor's in English.
Yes, you did.
That is highly hireable.
Creative writing, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Very lucrative job opportunities.
And I'm Cassidy from Los Angeles.
Did you have to think about it?
For a second, yeah, because I was thinking Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were just here.
I was just there. Yeah. I was in your hometown, or not your hometown. I was in your current town, and we were visiting for your boyfriend's birthday.
Yeah.
And he was sick the entire weekend.
Yep. We planned a party. We were going to have a barbecue with all our friends over, and then he got a fever. He'd had one for a couple days, and we were like, yeah, that's not happening.
Yeah.
We're canceling.
He was in fever denial.
No, I think it was just, we just thought, will we get people sick if they come over or not? Should we risk it? No, that's probably not fair to other people.
Yeah, I ended up okay. I was knocking on wood the whole time, and I was definitely in close enough proximity that there should have been some exposure.
Yeah, I mean, I've been fine for 2 weeks. I mean,
yeah, it's just one of those things. What he had that like, that thermometer gun thing that he was putting in his mouth
yeah.
the whole time. And I was like playing with it one night, and I had it like, I was trying to like measure the heat coming from my hand. And then he's like, just so you know, that's been in my mouth. And it didn't even occur to me that he was using it as
that
a
he was
way
warning
to,
you.
Yeah. I just thought he was just like, haha, it's been in my mouth.
Later, you were like, oh, shit.
Later, I was like, oh, shit. I'm probably going to get sick now. But I didn't.
Yeah, you're fine.
So that's good. But we did go see a movie. We ended up seeing Christopher Robin while I was down there. And not too long before that, I had seen the Bo Burnham movie, Eighth Grade, which I'm going to talk about. We have some movie news and some stuff. So we got a show. We got a show.
Yeah.
We can do this. We're going to start the show off here with our segment, which you had no idea existed, even though I know you listened to the show.
I know that you guys talk about these things, but I forgot that it was called Obey and Consume.
Obey, Consume. We're going to get some audio drops here pretty soon. I just put it on Twitter again. I've had multiple people tell me they're working on it. They just have never seen any audio. But Obey, Consume, this is the segment where we talk about what we're watching, what we're listening to, what we're reading, what are we consuming. And I'll let you go first. Is there anything, what's cool?
The thing that has really made an impact on me recently in terms of entertainment was a memoir that I just finished listening to on Audible. It's called Educated by Tara Westover. It's about her, her life growing up in very rural southern Idaho. She grows up Ooh. In the mountains with these kind of like extremist, anti-government parents. Her dad, is very paranoid that the end of the world is coming. And so him and his family kind of just make it their number one priority their whole life to prepare for the end of times. So she used to even sleep as a child in her bed with her like emergency backpack that has like a thermal blanket and like a bottle of water. And
holy shit.
Yeah. So she basically, what's most interesting about this book is that her parents were so anti-government, anti-everything, that she was born and did not even have a birth certificate until she was until she was nine. She had a delayed certificate of birth. And then so for 9 years, the government and the state like didn't know she existed. And then and her parents never put her in school. So she never had an education whatsoever. She learned how to read and that was it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she wasn't even homeschooled?
Not really. No, like her dad owned a junkyard and her mom was home, and they believe in herbal remedies for all needs. So like they never go to doctors. And like in the book, there are some terribly frightening accidents that happen to her family members. And it is a miracle that any of them survived some of these horrific things. Were like major third degree burns. I mean, holy cow. It's very scary. So they only believe in herbal remedies. They believe that if you have enough faith in God, of course, that you'll be healed. So they're like kind of an extremist Mormon sect, I would say.
Right.
And so she grows up just thinking that, you know, this is like her dad is right and that everyone else is wrong.
So it's like a doomsday prepper kind of scenario.
Very much. And so, yeah, she's not homeschooled. Her mom is kind of just doing herbal remedies and encourages her kids to like, if they want to like read some books, they can read gospel sermons or the Bible or the Book of Mormon, stuff like that. But yeah, that's like she grew up her whole life without an education, without ever really consuming entertainment or other books.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, one of her older siblings leaves and goes to college, and he recommends that she gets out as well. And that's kind of what starts her journey. She gets accepted to BYU in Utah when she's 17 to start a bachelor's. And she goes and has no idea what to expect or kind of what the protocol is socially.
Mm-hmm.
And she raises her hand in one of her very first lectures and asks what the Holocaust is. And people were thinking that she was just being like,
silly.
Yeah, like anti-Semite. And she was like, no, really, I don't know what this is. So she like went to the library and was like mortified. She thought that it was like on the terms of like, so she thought that it was like the Boston Massacre, which like 5 people died in that. She had no idea that it was like 6 million people. I mean, just
right.
Can you imagine? And then learning about the civil rights movement. It is so fascinating to hear this story through her eyes as she's experiencing it all as an adult. It's really incredible. So she goes on to talk about how much further she carries her education and kind of how that affects her family relationship.
That's crazy. So that you're listening to this on audiobook?
Yeah, I finished it already and it's just amazing. Yeah, audiobook.
What is it called?
It's called Educated by Tara Westover.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds super interesting. I hope they make a documentary or something. Like, that would be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love those kind of stories. I watched the Joe Rogan podcast like last year or so, where one of the Westboro Baptist Church girls, she was on there and she talked about her whole experience of like deconversion and leaving and being ostracized by her family and all that.
Wow.
And it was fascinating. That was like, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah. Cool. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I have been obsessed pretty much since I left Las Vegas a couple weeks ago, or weekend before last, with this hard rock heavy metal band. I don't know exactly how you'd describe them, called Zeal and Ardor. And I originally found out about them through our friendly podcast neighbor, the Listening Party podcast. I was listening to podcasts on the way back home, from Las Vegas, and they were talking about them. They featured this artist on that particular episode. And it's this, he's a Swedish guy. He's half black. And he's like a composer. He, you know, he mostly does electronic music and that kind of stuff, but he was bored one night and he kind of hit a creative lull. So he went on to the music boards at 4chan, which if anyone knows anything about 4chan, that's like where the alt-right was birthed. So it's the darkest corners of the internet. But it's kind of like Reddit in that they have lots of different subjects you can look up. And it predates Reddit, actually. But so he was on there, and he decided as a game, he would ask two different people a musical genre, and then he would have as a part of the experiment, he would try and combine them no matter what the two people told him. So one person said Norwegian black metal, and then the other person called him the N-word because it's 4chan. So rather than just getting upset and saying, and or trying to get another one or a better answer or something like that, he decides to take the prompt seriously, and he makes a combination of Norwegian black metal and early 18th, 19th century slave spirituals.
Wow.
And it's the coolest fucking music ever.
Nice.
I would say it's a, you know, if you're talking about like the combination, it depends. Like he's made two albums now. It started as just kind of a joke, and then he decided he wanted to keep doing it. So it, now he has like two albums worth of material on Spotify. But he, I would say that the, you know, the ratio to black metal to blues or whatever you want to call it, varies from song to song, but I would say usually kind of around 70% kind of like blues or, slave chant or whatever. Mm-hmm. And about 30% black metal, like just enough to kind of give it an edge, just enough to kind of know that that's where he's drawing from, where he sort of utilizes the atmosphere of that style of music. But there isn't as much like screaming or wretched vocals or like blast beats or the type of stuff that kind of turns people off, or I should say normal people off from that kind of music.
Interesting.
But one of the things that's really cool about the project is that there's also sort of a literary aspect to it. He's sort of telling this sort of grander narrative. It's sort of this revisionist history where, the thing about Norwegian black metal, besides, you know, being dark and scary and wearing face paint and all of that stuff is that most of the music is satanic. Like, that's their whole thing. It's like they like burn down churches and sing about Satan. And so when he decided to combine these two genres, the thought experiment that he went with was, what if instead of the slaves taking on the religion of their captors, they decide to reject it and become Satanists?
Hmm.
It's, kind of brings like a whole new weight to that sort of thing. Cause, you know, nowadays, like back in the early 90s when the bands in Norway were actually burning down churches, and it was, you know, members of one band were like killing members of the other band, and it was getting kind of hairy back mm-hmm. then. Nowadays, black metal is sort of a meme. It's sort of like, it's very trendy. And I thought I was kind of done with that as a genre. Like everyone's done black metal. It is to the world of extreme metal, what like zombies is to like pop culture in movies. Like we're kind of over it now.
Yeah.
But this has really breathed whole new life into it. And puts a more sort of like cultural specificity to it that kind of makes you examine it from another angle. Anyways, I love it. I love the music. Besides all this like smart reasons to like it, it just rocks. It's like, ton of hooks, tons of grooves, easy to sing along to. And I would say to people who are kind of squeamish about the black metal thing, if that's just not your thing, I would say that it's a lot more kind of in the camp or the world of something like a Nick Cave or Tom Waits or sort of like that sort of like American Gothic, Southern Gothic rock kind of thing.
Sure.
But I dig it, and I already bought tickets to see them in October, and it's going to be really cool around Halloween, and I'm into it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Check it out. Zeal and Ardor. And all their stuff is on Spotify.
Yeah, you should tweet about that so that you can get the spelling right.
Yeah.
Not sure how I would spell that.
Okay. Let's go ahead and do some movie news.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
And the first story, I'll do this one. This just popped up today. I have it open. Tessa Thompson is set to star in Disney's Lady and the Tramp remake. opposite Justin Theroux.
What?
yeah, right?
They're remaking Lady and the Tramp?
Well, you know, they're like, there's the Dumbo remake that's coming out.
They're just doing everything, but are they doing this one with, like, CGI dogs?
Well, I was kind of wondering that myself. So I'm trying to find like where it kind of talks about this a little in more in depth, but it says, the original 1955 animated classic tells the story of a female American Cocker Spaniel named Lady, blah, blah, blah. We know all this. When the two dogs meet, they embark on a romantic adventure, blah, blah, blah. As we previously reported, Justin Theroux will voice Tramp, and now, it will be Thompson chewing down the other end of the iconic piece of spaghetti. So they said voice, so I'm assuming this is going, they say, okay, here it is. It says Disney's live action / CG hybrid remake. So I'm guessing the dogs are going to be kind of CGI, but sort of like, Uncanny Valley, probably too realistic CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And then the human characters are going to be probably people and the environments are probably going to be real. I would assume sort of like the Dumbo, like, that's coming out, like, that's, I imagine that's the direction, but it's being made for Disney's upcoming streaming service.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it's and not I've, like a wide release like Beauty and the Beast.
I don't know. I don't know if they're going to try and do a maybe day and date kind of thing where you can watch it. You can either watch it on the streaming service or watch it in theater. I'm not sure how they're going to go about that.
Hmm.
So Tessa Thompson's like getting bigger and bigger now. She is a known quantity at this point. She was recently in Sorry to Bother You and Creed. She's going to be in the upcoming Creed 2, I'm sure. Thor Ragnarok, Dear White People, which was the first thing I saw her in. Do you have an opinion about this?
I mean, we can't stop them. They are cash grabbing because they know that there will be an audience for this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they almost don't have to worry about the marketing, I feel like. You know? Yeah. So they're going to do what they're going to do. I don't think they should be doing this stuff.
I haven't liked many of these remakes that they've been doing, these live action remakes of old Disney cartoons. Like, I don't see the point for them because the animated films are, for the most part, masterpieces, especially these older ones. And they still hold up. Like, the cool thing about animation is...
Right? It doesn't age.
It doesn't age.
Yeah, I was just now, talking to someone about this, that when I was a kid, I watched Snow White. I watched The Aristocats.
Yeah, Pinocchio. Up,
right next to Pocahontas. You could not have told me that one of them was made in 1937 and the other was 1996. Like...
Right.
I would have had no idea. And Aristocrats came out in, or Aristocats came out in 1970s. I had no idea.
How old it was, for sure.
Yeah. It's just
fairy there's like some things about it. Like, like the voice acting and the storytelling and things like that varies a little bit from generation to generation, but it's not like as jarring for a kid to watch Pinocchio as it is for a kid to watch like, you know, The Searchers or something like that, or, you know, something from that era that's in live action.
I will say that if you're a little bit more of a woke child nowadays and you watch Pinocchio, you're going to be like, what the fuck is happening? It's pretty creepy.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But other than that.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of whatever as far as this goes. I'm surprised this is one they want to tackle, because to me, this is, of all of Disney's animated films, this one I think has the least amount of, like, immediate appeal. It's a love story.
Yeah.
It's a very classically told love story. Like, if you look at just the nuts and bolts of that story, it's like, you know, it's essentially a melodrama for children.
With dogs.
Like, with dogs, yeah. Whereas, you know, some of their more like fantastical things, Sleeping Beauty or what have you, that sort of genre kind of transcends era to era. Where I don't know if kids would necessarily be as into this now, but I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. If they're going to do a live action of all the princesses, I think it would be interesting to go for Snow White because the story is quite short. I think it's just over an hour, the movie, and there's really not a lot of character development. I would love to be in the writing room and working out the plot of that one because there's a lot of things in that plot that doesn't make sense to me. Like if this prince is in a neighboring kingdom that's pretty close by and how they all know each other and how she's not already betrothed to him. I don't know. It's very weird.
I get you. I wonder if they'll keep the insanely racist We Are Siamese number.
Oh, I don't know.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
Who knows how they're... I mean, if they do, like, wow.
Wow.
But, I mean, I'm not going to lie. That song's kind of a jam. But it is, as a 30-whatever-year-old 2018 person, I can look at that and go, yeah, that was pretty racist.
Yeah.
Okay. What else happened? Oh, okay. Do we want a little update on the James Gunn news?
Yes.
This is pretty easy to kind of cover. So,
I've heard it from both ends of the spectrum that there's no way he's coming back and that they are talking about bringing him back.
Right.
Or at least the script. I don't know.
So Dave Bautista says that he doesn't want to do Guardians of the Galaxy 3 if they don't use James Gunn's script.
Right.
Now, Dave Bautista has probably been the most vocal of the Guardians cast about bringing James Gunn back and how he got a raw deal and blah, blah, blah. He's very much in James Gunn corner. Mm-hmm. All of them are, but I would say he is very much spearheading this online.
Yeah.
But he gritted his teeth and said he'll come back to be in the movie so long as they use James Gunn's script. I don't know if Disney has come to a consensus on that or what the plan is there. But a little while later, I saw this article, from the AV Club that says that, they're calling it a rumor. So that this is not substantiated in really any kind of way, but that James Gunn, there's whispers in Disney headquarters to bring Gunn back.
Yeah.
Even though they had said their official statement was there was no such talks.
It would look very weird of them to backpedal, but I think they should. I think in the first place, they should have just acknowledged the troll that purposely did this to get Gunn fired and say, those tweets have been public record for quite some time and we've talked to him about it. You know, like we've discussed it. It's none of your business. Move on. That's what they should have done in the first place.
They should have done that on day one or two. Exactly. Yeah. But now they're in this position where they've waited so long that there is like these entrenched camps on both sides.
Yeah.
And, no matter what decision they make, it's sort of a lose-lose for them, at least within this little cooling off period. Now, I think, and I speculated this last time that we talked about this in the news, that I think they could be just waiting for it to blow over. Because they haven't immediately hired somebody else. They haven't even put up a list of people they would like to have do it. Fans have. People have suggested things. But Disney hasn't said anything officially yet, so maybe what they're doing is they're like, okay, this looks bad. Let's just wait it out. Let's kind of see where the chips lie after a few months and then make an official decision or whatever. And maybe that's what they mean by rumors.
Yeah. I think Disney so much of their money comes from tourists coming to the parks and people seeing their movies. So I understand that they always want to do something that's the least confrontational and kind of the least gutsy. But
right.
I just think, gosh, he wrote those tweets like a decade ago. Everyone changes in 10 years quite a lot. I just can't imagine why they couldn't just stand up for him and be like, he's been an exceptional director. You know, we really care about him and his actors enjoy working with them. And they could have polled the actors and said, you know, how do you feel about James Gunn? And they would have all been like, yes, because so many people have come forward and been like, I really appreciate him and the way he helped me in this movie that we did together. Like even Selma Blair was speaking up about it. So I think.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like,
yeah,
it's like just, within all of this time, there's been plenty of time for if he had done anything fucked up in real life, that somebody would have stepped forward.
Sure.
But nobody has. And everybody that's worked with him is only standing up for him. Even going as far back as, you know, Lloyd Kaufman, the president and CEO of Troma. So I don't think there's a there, but Disney might just hedging their bets at this point and just kind of waiting and seeing. I'm not placing my bet on him coming back. I think, especially this far out, I think they sort of have to commit to their choice. I think it's a long shot, but I'm still holding out.
Yeah. Would you have rather pissed off some Nazis or, you know, stood up for someone that made you some really good movies and some really big money? Mm-hmm. I think they made the wrong decision. So there you go.
Agreed. Okay, cool. Last story, and this is the big one, I think. The Oscars are adding a new category for popular films, and the telecast is no longer going to air all of the awards given out.
Okay.
So it's going to be a lot like the Grammys, I suppose, where they hand out probably like the Big Five, or I don't know how many they're going to scale down. I guarantee things like sound mixing and sound editing, or it's maybe some of the shorts, stuff like that.
For will the not Tonys, make it up. They just do lighting, technical, those kinds of things. They do those during commercial breaks. And then when they come back from the commercial breaks, they'll show maybe a 10-second snippet from each of those people getting those awards and thanking a couple of people, and then they move on.
Mm-hmm.
So they could do that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't care.
You're fine with that. What's your opinion of the popular film category?
I guess I don't understand. Does it mean... What does it mean?
Well, yeah, nobody knows. Right now, the Academy has not released anything as far as like what the standards would be for this award. Does it mean what's made money? Does it mean what's had the highest cinema scores? Does it mean what has the highest rating on IMDb? I don't know.
I would like, say it must be what makes the most money.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a combination between cinema score and box office.
Yeah.
Because there's no other way really to kind of garner that. Now, here's the thing. I think it's bullshit. But I'm not saying it's bullshit from like an elitist, get your stinking populist films out of my Oscars kind of perspective. I'm actually saying it's bullshit on behalf of the populist films. Because back before there was an animated film category, that's a relatively new category in the world of the Academy Awards. The animated film category, I think, was added a year or two after Beauty and the Beast was nominated for Best Picture and didn't win, right? So they make this amendment. They decide, you know what? There's enough animated film that it's a competitive category. We should create a category for it.
But they're making it 27 years later? I mean...
Well, no. The animated film category has been there for a long time.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
That's been a category since the mid-90s or something like that. But here's the thing. Now, if an animated film does get any recognition at all, it's sort of relegated just to that category. So, like in the case of Toy Story 3, Toy Story 3 was nominated for Best Animated Film and Best Picture. So you knew that it was not going to win Best Picture because they have that award for animated film. It's going to win that. And then the best picture will go to something else. So the same thing could be said about quote unquote popular films. So let's say a film that's a blockbuster or a film that's somewhat genre or something like that, something like a Get Out, right? That would be a good, or like an Inception or something like that. Films that are not prestige films exactly. They're made more for populist audiences. That's going to get relegated into this popular film category. And even if it's one of those is so big that they have to also include it into the best picture category, well, now we know it's definitely not going to win.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to win that popular film category. So that just means that the best picture of the year, what everyone's going to call the real Oscar, is right. going to always be sort of this dry end of the year prestige film.
Right.
And I actually, and I actually want more populist films to be in consideration for best picture. Not because I think like Transformers movies are great art or anything like that, but because I think if there's a notion out there, anything that can create for better movies, I think is a good thing. And so generally speaking, I don't really care about the Oscars. I think it's the pageantry of it is kind of fun. But other than that, I mostly don't care. But what it does do is it creates some amount of competition within the studio system to create better films some of the time. And now if there's this best, you know, popular film category or whatever, nobody's going to be trying to shoot for the stars when it comes to what they're putting out for blockbusters or for populist filmmaking. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Do you have anything to add?
I don't know.
I just said a lot of stuff.
I really don't count the Oscars as any kind of important decision. But of course, in Hollywood, Leo worked right. so hard to get that Oscar. So I understand right. how important it is to other people. But mainly, I just want there to be more mid-budget movies, and I want mm-hmm. people to fund those still. And if that can happen because of this, then that's great. If it's taking away from that, then I don't like it.
Well, you know, I didn't even think about that. But yeah, I think that this category would also put a big dent into that, into the mid-budget desire, because now you're really looking at movies in two ways. You're looking at prestige and popular.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're only looking at them in those kind of narrow, you know, bipolar sort of ways, then you're only thinking about things in terms of, well, is this going to be, you know, a tadpole or a tentpole?
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the quote unquote small movies, you know, movies like, The King's Speech, or, I don't know, what's a kind of dry, mediocre prestige film that people want to win Oscars? The Post. Yeah. Movies like that are going to, only be in the Oscar category. Instead, you know, you won't have something kind of off kilter. Like with something like this existing, would Silence of the Lambs ever have had a chance?
Hmm.
You know, a horror movie that was released in February?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know either. So I'm not into it. And I'm not into it for probably different reasons, and people would think that I'm not into it. Because it is, whether we want to consider the Oscars as an important thing or a real mark of any kind of valor or whatever, it does have an effect on the industry.
Yes.
And that's what I'm looking at. As far as like the best films of the year, or like what I think are like actually the interesting movies people should be talking about, I honestly think that the Independent Spirit Awards, which they show the night before, is a lot closer to what my end of the year mm-hmm. list usually looks like
right.
than what the Oscars list looks like.
Hmm.
And they have cool categories. And, you know, a lot of people have talked about that too. It's like, if you're going to introduce all these categories, or, you know, new categories to get people to watch, well, then why don't you have something like best stunt coordination, or, you know, I don't know. I've seen other things too, but, or best ensembles or whatever, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the bullshit that's happening right now.
Yep.
All right. I'll go ahead and do a short review for Eighth Grade. Okay. So this is Eighth Grade, the debut feature from the stand-up comedian and YouTube celebrity Bo Burnham. Are you familiar with Bo Burnham?
Not really. Cade, my boyfriend, is more of a fan.
He was the first person who ever showed me a Bo Burnham video. Now, Bo got famous in the early days of YouTube making videos from his basement, or from his bedroom, I should say, from his parents' bedroom as a teenager. He was only like 17, 16 years old, doing these song parodies and these kind of silly raps and that kind of stuff. It would just be him and a keyboard. And I guess what he's really known for is being hyper verbose, very lyrical in his delivery, and very wordy, and a lot of like word play, and also very filthy. So his stuff is very crass and usually kind of juvenile, but I think the appeal of his comedy for people who like his comedy is that it's very juvenile in subject matter, but he's using like very elevated language as he's making like dick and fart jokes.
Yeah.
So he's clearly a very smart person, made a lot of money very early on. Now he can tour, you know, the theater circuit and that kind of stuff. He's been in, Judd Apatow movies, and he's a thing now, outside of the realm of YouTube. You know, he's graduated well past that at this point. Now, me personally, I've never been really a big Bo Burnham fan. I thought he was mildly funny as a YouTube thing, but then when I saw him doing that shtick on stage, I thought, like, you're a really good writer, you're definitely smart, but I can feel that you know that you're a good writer and you're smart, and that kind of, like, puts too much distance between me and him for me to fully get into his comedy. Mm-hmm. It's so practiced, it's so precise, that it feels a little too synthetic for me. For me personally, that's just my taste as far as what I like in stand-up. But I've always acknowledged that he is kind of a prodigy of sorts, and definitely intelligent. And so when I saw that he was doing this movie, Eighth Grade, and somebody told me it was a Bo Burnham thing, I was like, oh, Jesus, like, no thank you. And then I saw the trailer.
Right.
And I was like, well, that's interesting.
Right.
The
trailer's awesome. That's all I've seen of it.
Yeah. So I had to go see it for myself, and I'll just get into the story, and then I'll go from there. So this is a coming of age story about a young girl, named Kayla, who is sort of an outcast at her school. She is a YouTuber as well. She makes little videos from her home, just giving like little life tips and advice and things like that. And a lot of times, kind of what we come to realize as we're watching the movie is the advice that she's giving to people is the advice that she wants to take for herself. Mm-hmm. She comes off with a lot more confidence on camera than she does when she's around real people. And there's a lot about this movie about like how teenagers kind of live these double lives, you know, the life they live online.
Oh, yeah.
The persona that they carry online versus the persona that they have in company.
Or everyone doing that.
To an extent, this does. Yeah, this definitely extends out. This becomes a more universal story in that sense. And I think Bo Burnham said something to the effect that, you know, in this day and age, everybody's kind of in eighth grade again. Like, everybody feels a little awkward.
Yeah.
And he kind of uses Kayla's story to tell everyone's story, specifically his story. I think this movie is kind of autobiographical in a subversive way. But she's being raised by a single father, played by Josh Hamilton. Josh Hamilton isn't all that confident in the movie himself. He has a lot of his own kind of neurosis about being a father, about being a single father, raising a 13, 14-year-old. This takes place within the last week of eighth grade, and she's about to transition. She hasn't had a very good middle school year. She has virtually no friends. Other than some very light acquaintances that even those don't really want to hang out with her all that much. At one point in the movie, she sort of begrudgingly gets invited to a popular girl's birthday party, a pool party, and everyone sort of ignores her and she leaves sad. Mm-hmm. And these are the kind of day-to-day things happen in the movie. It's not really a comedy, which is the first surprising thing, knowing Bo Burnham's background. This movie is a pretty much a fly-on-the-wall kind of experience. I think he's trying to tell the story as realistically as possible. And one of the things that I really appreciated it, one of the reasons why I really appreciated it, is that this is a movie about young teenagers who don't sound like 37-year-old screenwriters.
I see.
These are teenagers who actually talk like teenagers talk like when they're that age. They're not eloquent. They can't express their feelings very well. They might say one thing and then contradict themselves a little bit later. They might trip over their words a lot. Now, in so many ways, this movie juxtaposes against Bo Burnham as a comedian in really interesting ways. So one of the things I was saying about Bo Burnham's stage thing is that it's very practiced. It's very wordy. He has to hit his punchlines exactly where they are. It's very, very precise comedy. This is so not that way at all. It's very loose. And it's very organic, and the dialogue feels almost improvised. And I would be surprised in some cases if it wasn't. But there is a line here or there, or you see how the dialogue is being used in overdub or something like that. They might use it as a way of doing narration where it juxtaposes with what we're seeing on screen that you think, okay, this probably was written. But if that's the case, damn, these actors are really good, especially for kids. Specifically, Elsie Fisher, who's playing Kayla here, you know, we're experiencing basically all of this through her head. In some ways, this almost kind of feels like an extension, sort of a realistic extension of that movie Inside Out. Like, yeah. Except we're just watching this experience through her eyeballs rather than through this like little internal battle of animated characters in her head.
Mm-hmm.
But we're living vicariously through her, through this whole movie. It's one of the most personalized experiences I've seen on film in a long time, as far as putting you in the headspace of a character. And if you've ever been of a certain age where you felt awkward, or you felt out of place, or you felt like nobody liked you, or you felt like no matter what you did to seem cool, it was just making you look worse, this movie's gonna resonate. It's very realistic. It's, some might say, kind of cringy in its reality.
Yeah.
Like, it puts you in places you're like, oh, I remember that. Mm-hmm. And there's some really interesting things about, you know, he does here with the fact that he's telling sort of this universal story through a girl. And he doesn't ignore that. There's a lot of stuff here that is very specific to young women. And there's some, like, early sexual politics stuff in here that, you know, kind of awkward and kind of bumbling and also kind of like endearing, but also kind of scary. And there's some scenes in here that it's about as close to America will ever get to doing a Catherine Brûlé kind of like fat girl story. And that was a movie of a name of a Catherine Brûlé film, Fat Girl, about a young girl going through her sexual awakening at age whatever. And it's a French film, so it's allowed to like totally go there, whereas American films definitely will never will. But this movie has moments where you're like, oh, this is like kind of going there in some like surprising ways.
Hmm.
I like the movie a lot. I like the movie immensely. I think this is like one of the best movies about teenage years, about specifically this pocket of the teenage years, you know, where you're transitioning out of childhood into adolescence and there's, some definite growing pains that happen within that transition,
mm-hmm.
Where you haven't really found yourself yet. You haven't really developed a clear personality. And it's interesting to be so thoroughly in the headspace of somebody who has no idea who they are.
Yeah.
So yeah, I adore this film. And, it made me look at Bo Burnham in a completely different way. I think this is definitely the best thing that he's ever put his name on, mm-hmm. for me personally. Again, I've just never been a fan of his comedy, but more of this. Yes, please.
Yeah, that's great. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, please do. I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, thank you.
Okay. So let's get into Christopher Robin, which is a movie that I saw while I was visiting you and your sick boyfriend. Do you want to set that up? What happens in Christopher Robin?
Oh, gosh. The whole beginning starts with this kind of montage of, like, who Christopher Robin was as a boy. And the scene opens up as his last day in Hundred Acre Woods. And he's playing with the animals. And they have, like, a goodbye party with cake. And he says goodbye to Pooh. And then he goes off to boarding school. And then it shows a montage of his life, kind of showing how he got from point A to point B, which is, in the end, he's kind of this surly adult and exhausted, overworked, stressed out by, you know, budget cuts and deadlines and stuff like that from his job. And therefore, he kind of is an absent father and husband to his daughter and wife. And he promises that he's going to take them out to his home cottage from when he was a boy for the weekend. But then he gets wrangled into working for that weekend. And so he has to send his family off without them and without him. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly Pooh is back in his life and he kind of goes through some hijinks to try to figure out how to get them back to the 100-acre wood, and some different stuff happens after that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's essentially right. Now, you were really insistent on seeing this. I'd already seen Eighth Grade, but I was like, I'll see the damn thing again. Right. Let's go do this. And you were really like, you were on board with Christopher Robin.
It's not that. It's Cade got a free movie ticket for his birthday, and that was going to expire that week. So we kind of wanted to use that, and I just wanted to see it. I wish that I could have used my movie pass, but it was not available at that point because they're going through some difficulties.
Yes, they are.
But, I did want to see it. You know, funnily enough, I never grew up watching the cartoons. I never saw the movie until recently from the 70s. Mm-hmm. So I have never been a Winnie the Pooh fan and don't really know anything about them other than Eeyore is depressed. So.
Right. So. Up until recently, anyway.
Right. But I do love Ewan McGregor. That was kind of definitely one of the things that got me in the chair. So.
This is directed by Mark Forster, who also did the movie kind of similarly pitched Finding Neverland with Johnny Depp back in 2004. And then an indie film called The Kite Runner, Monsters Ball, which got a lot of acclaim at a time. So he's a guy. I don't know. You know, to me, this is kind of Finding Neverland light.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. There's a lot of, I was talking to you about this, when we were visiting. There's a lot of echoes of Steven Spielberg's Hook as far as the themes go. This idea of losing your childhood or forgetting your childhood or forgetting the joy of being a child and having to go on sort of a magical realist adventure in order to get in touch with your inner child again, all of those kind of themes.
Yeah, that's exactly this movie.
The play into it, and it, you know, it's fine, it's harmless. You know, a lot of the animation I really like, some of it looks like puppetry, and then some of it's obviously CGI. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's a combination of the both. But it pulls off very well. It reminded me a little bit of what the creatures from Where the Wild Things Are kind of looked like, but much smaller scale. Mm-hmm. But their relation to space and sort of the textures and that kind of stuff. And I like the way that those characters come off. And I grew up with Winnie the Pooh, and I had seen the cartoon as a young kid. And I had watched the live action Winnie the Pooh television show that they used to have on the Disney Channel when I was a kid. So I have some amount of connection to these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way that they come off in the movie, and I like all of the sequences with them kind of talking and hanging out. There's kind of some weird plot stuff that happens that sort of distracts me and I think sort of derails the movie. There's, you know, Pooh comes back into his life. They head back to 100 Acre Wood so he can return him because he's just too much of a reckless bear. There's a lot of Paddington going on in there too.
Yeah.
He's this reckless bear. He's making big messes, so he has to take him back to 100 Acre Wood. Now, that's where I thought the movie would get started. I was like, okay, now we're in 100 Acre Wood. They're going to have fun adventures. He's going to find everybody. They're going to be hanging out in the 100 Acre Wood, and it's going to be adult Christopher Robin hanging. And then it ends up being this thing where for some reason they're in the streets of London and trying to stay hidden from the cab driver and not expose themselves and all this kind of wacky hijink stuff that I just really didn't need. And I thought was totally not in tune with the tone of the movie up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of I don't know, Smurfs in the Big City kind of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And, I, I guess it kind of pulls together ultimately. Like, it doesn't become so obnoxious, but ultimately, I just didn't really feel much one way or the other for this movie. Mm-hmm. It's so inoffensive, it barely exists.
Inoffensive. I think that the...
I know that you cried, so you have to tell me why.
Okay, so I cried at multiple points in this movie because they're just... I think that that's what they were going for. I think they want adults to introduce their kids to Winnie the Pooh, and I want, mm-hmm. and I think they want adults to come and kind of relive their childhood and find a piece of themselves. I think this is way more meant for adults, kind of my age or older, that grew up watching the Winnie the Pooh. And
yeah,
so I think it's meant to kind of really just tug at the heartstrings, and I think that's why they can get away with an oversimplified plot,
mm-hmm.
because they're just really banking on getting you emotional about it. So I was emotional because, well, at one point, it's because it takes place in the 40s, and so he does have to go away as a young soldier and in World War II, and he has to fight and be away from his wife, whom he's just impregnated. So,
yeah, that's exactly how they word it, too.
Exactly. So he gets on a train to go to World War II, and she's pregnant, and he does not come back until his daughter is about 3 years old. And I was just crying about that because I thought, when we really needed to pull together and literally save the world from Nazis. So, and just to imagine not knowing if you had a boy or a girl, or, you know, how old they are and how old they're going to be by the time you finally get home and this war is over, because it dragged for a long time. You know, millions of people died. I think that that is so emotional in the beginning, just for me, especially because I just went to the World War II Museum. So it was just fresh in my head, all of that.
So there's some extra context there.
But also, I think just the emotion of who do you really become? And if you were a kid looking back on yourself, I mean, is that who you wanted to be in the first place? I think there's a lot of questions that people can leave the theater asking themselves, even if it was kind of a silly plot. I think it still leaves you thinking about it a little bit more.
Okay, yeah. You know, I think for the most part, the emotional storytelling here works. When it's him and Pooh and they're having this conversation, when it's not just hijinks, when they're actually like trying to turn these animals into characters and letting them be characters, mm-hmm. I think that stuff plays.
Yeah.
And that's why I wanted more of it. Unfortunately, I think the majority of the movie, they are plot devices to get Christopher Robin from point A to point B.
Right.
And I wish that there had been more about learning about himself through these characters rather than, you know, all of this stuff about like, oh, I got a meeting. I'm really late for this meeting.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. That would have been better.
I don't want to reiterate the movies, which this reminded me so much of, but, you know, Where the Wild Things Are specifically. And as far as the kind of somber, rainy tone, and then the themes of Hook. And that's a movie that was lambasted by critics when it came out. Hook is a movie that, like, unless you were exactly my age, it is like not. It. Yeah, like, if you were any bit older, if you were 14 years old or older when that movie came out, you were like, what the shit is this? But if you were exactly my age, then it is a big part of your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, I mean, even for a movie that nobody liked at the time, I think that that's quite a bit more sophisticated on the storytelling level. And Where the Wild Things Are, I think, digs in a little deeper emotionally. Maybe too much, actually. this movie just kind of didn't really do much for me in any regard, other than I thought the animation was really nice. I liked the voice acting a lot. Jim Cummings comes in to do his Pooh. I think he does a couple characters, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That all, you know, that stuff works. Mark Forster knows how to set up a shot. He knows how to create an emotional reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are those moments that where he can tug at your heartstrings, and he's able to manipulate the audience pretty seamlessly. But then if I think for 2 seconds about what's actually happening on screen, then it kind of falls apart for me.
I think most people will go to this and just have had a really lovely time. I think they'll come out of it feeling like it has a great ending. And I think that most people will be very satisfied with it. But yeah, if you were to, you know, poke it any and or, you know, get any closer to examining it, then it's going to fall apart.
I don't think it's a bad movie. It's like I said, it's inoffensive. It's fine. You know, I'd be interested to know how kids react to it because it is, it is kind of somber. It's a little slow, but then there is that kind of hijinksy stuff, which now I'm thinking about it. Maybe that was sort of directed from Disney to like amp it up a little.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe those studio notes in there. I'm not sure. Yeah, I give it like a C.
I don't know. I mean, I enjoy the period that it takes place in, and Ewan McGregor, I think, is a great actor. I think he doesn't have enough to go on. It's kind of one note because his lines over and over again are, I've got to get to work.
I've got this meeting.
Yep. So, you know, I don't know. I don't like grading things.
Okay.
Well,
you can just let your review lie.
Yeah. I think it's enjoyable on a surface level. And, you know, they definitely know how to make you tear up a little. So there you go.
Okay. Cool. So we don't have an official Netflix homework because I kind of brought you on as an emergency guest. But we're gonna give some Netflix recommendations, you know, one from you, one from me. And I'll let you start. What have you been watching on Netflix? What should people be looking at?
So there's this new show, and have you heard of the website Vox, V-O-X?
Yeah, yeah, articles and stuff.
So
I call that site the TLDR website because all their articles are, I read about 45% of it, and I'm like, okay, Jesus Christ, it's still going?
Okay, good to know. Well, they, that's funny because this Vox website made a TV show on Netflix and it's called Explained. Have you heard of this?
Maybe.
Explained.
Go on.
Is they do new shows every Wednesday, so it's kind of like a weekly segment on Netflix, which I think is fun and cool. So they dive into a 15-minute topic. So there you go. Like that's not too long to read.
No.
Oh my gosh, this is still going. It's very much just a kind of capsule of information about one particular topic. And I think they are interesting topics and fun. Some of them are playful. Like they have a whole thing about cricket where they try to explain the rules of the game and how complicated it is and how it's evolved. And it was interesting. And I had no idea about any of it. So you're always walking away learning something new, I think, by watching this.
Okay.
But some of the other episodes are really compelling. There's one that's about DNA editing, which is, you know, to maybe stop aging or make you smarter or faster or stronger, you know, stuff like that, DNA editing. And then there's another one about racial wealth gap, which I think everyone should watch. That one is pretty horrifying, where they lay out quite simply how, because we had slaves for 300 years at the beginning of our country, they are economically still behind us 300 years. So that is why housing neighborhoods, you know, that are more, that have a higher minority of Black people living in them, that's why they are undervalued or people are afraid to live in those places. Or it even talks about how they're afraid of Black people moving into white majority neighborhoods because they think it'll bring down their real estate value when it does nothing of the sort. So these are all latent racist issues that I think people are still dealing with. And
for
really,
sure.
We've never made restitution with what we've done to them as a whole.
Did they talk about red line districts?
I think maybe. I can't remember.
The concept of red line districts where when they do city planning, they actually behind a red line, like they'll, with a red pen, they'll mark out like the areas that the city planners have decided to essentially segregate people into.
I think they do talk about that.
This area, we will not, give as much money as we will these other areas.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fucked up.
Yep. So just some interesting topics. There's even one about, do we use the exclamation point too much? And that one's a fun, interesting one. And you never, I mean, you don't think about how complex our usage is and how many uses we have for that until you watch this. I think it's interesting. So, yeah.
I work in low-level marketing, and I have a different relationship with the exclamation point than I used to. Yes.
One of the points they make is that women use it more in workplaces because it makes them seem more friendly and less threatening. And if guys use it too much, then it's just weird and it reads totally wrong. But women should be using it more, but guys can't. It's a whole social thing. Like,
wow.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. What's the name of the show again?
Explained.
Explained on Netflix by the people over at Vox. Interesting. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
I want to recommend a movie, and it is called Out of Sight. Came out in 1997, I believe, 97 or 98. Stars George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, back when Jennifer Lopez was in good movies. And it's directed by Steven Soderbergh. It was one of his first real big commercial hits before he did the Ocean's movies and what have you. It's based on an Elmore and Leonard novel. It's about George Clooney plays a bank robber who escapes prison. And on his way out, he ends up in a trunk with a cop played by Jennifer Lopez. And, she's sort of hunting him down and falling in love with him at the same time. It's also a big ensemble. There's a lot of ins and outs, as a lot of Elmore Leonard plots go. There's a lot of, like, you know, this heist over here, and then there's these interested parties, but we gotta double cross them and get blah, 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 that kind of stuff. This was released the same year, I want to say pretty much around the same release date as Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown, which is also based on the Elmore Leonard novel. And there's a character played by Michael Keaton, a sort of a side character he plays in both movies. And because the two movies are done by two different studios, they actually had to cut through a lot of red tape just so that he could play the same character in both movies. Mm. But they thought it would be cool because Tarantino and Soderbergh were both kind of coming up in the world of filmmaking at the time. And they kind of cooked up this idea of, like, well, let's since we both have the same character in our movies, let's try and get the same actor to play him in both movies.
Weird. Cool.
Yeah, even though he's not even the main character in both movies. Right. but yeah, I saw this movie actually with a double feature with Jackie Brown over at Tarantino's The Beverly Theater here in Los Angeles, which has been closed for renovations for almost a year now. But Out of Sight is probably my favorite Steven Soderbergh movie.
No way.
And probably, yeah.
Wow.
And maybe I might actually like it even a little bit more than Jackie Brown, even though I love that movie as well.
Yeah, you do. Wow.
So I definitely recommend it.
Cool.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Yeah, thanks for being here.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
Doing the show and talking about this stuff with me. Is there anywhere you want people to find you online? Do you have a Twitter? Do you have an Instagram? Do you have a WhatsApp?
No, I don't have that.
You're not on WhatsApp yet?
No. You can follow me on Instagram, Ashley Hitchcock. Ashley with two
Ashley
E's.
Spelled with two E's, yep. Yes.
Hitchcock, like Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Cool. You can find us on Instagram as well, at Jabber Podcast. We don't update it, but it's there. We pretty much only post when we release new episodes, but I want to try. It's on my phone now. I want to try and actually be more active on there. I just need better ideas for what to post. I'm still kind of a novice at that particular app, but, we're on there. We're also, you can, reach us, through our email at jabberandjerone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can find us on Facebook and follow us at our Facebook group at facebook.com/Jabber Podcast, where we post new episodes, listener surveys every once in a while, and the news stories, if you want to comment on those. So what else? I do movie reviews for the Idaho State Journal, and sometimes I post those online, although not recently. But those can be seen at SouthforkReviews@blogspot.com or SouthforkReviews.blogspot.com.
How come you named your blog Salad Fork?
I don't know. I had no idea what to call it.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I wish I had a clever answer for that. I should think of one. You can also follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. And you should be checking out our friends, who I mentioned already, our podcast neighbors, The Listening Party. Or you could check out, Patrick, and, Dennis over at Almost Educational. You can check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast, Adam Connie over at the Adamant podcast, Keith's friends whose names I've already forgotten over at, Campfire Shit Show, and, Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. And I think that's it.
Wow. You got a lot of friends.
Yeah, we got some people out there.
In podcast places.
In podcast land. Yeah, we like to have a pod family of support.
Yeah.
Oh, and Mike Falick over at Hack Thought. And that's the show. That's the episode.
Cool.
You don't have a funny one-liner? Keith always says something.
No, I'm not as cool as Keith.
We'll leave it at that. Bye.
Bye.